Okay, we're officially being recorded, and it is Tuesday today, April, 28th, and it is now 1 o'clock, and we're starting our Chem3L lab. And can I go over how to convert PDF again? Mary. So there's a number of different ways to convert a document into a PDF. There was a couple of apps that I showed that I like to use that are iOS apps. So for Apple phone or Apple iPad, you can use these apps. I think that these apps may also be cross-platform and some other platforms as well. But the one application that I like to use is TurboScan. So TurboScan is this app that is here. And that app, when I open that app, it allows me to be able to take a photograph. And I can't point to the screen. I don't have a good way to be able to point to the screen and show you, but it allows me to be able to take photographs. And then when I hit share on a photograph, for instance, a document like this, I can go to any photograph that I've taken, hit share on that, and I can send it as a PDF through my email. So it just says email as PDF and allows me to send it that way. That's one way to do it. Anna is saying she uses an app called Cam Scanner. If you look at or go to any of your app stores for either Apple or Android or Microsoft, and you search for an app that is a scanning app for a cell phone, all of those apps should be able to send as a PDF. That's one of the easiest ways to do it. Or if you can take a picture from your phone and then be able to share that photograph, printing it, sometimes you can print it as a PDF. Brandon is also saying Office Lens. So there's a number of applications that are out there. Make a quick note real quick, jot them down, and see what you can do. See if you can send a PDF. And if not, I will always take them as photographs. So I'm never not going to grade them if you send them to me as a photograph. I'm going to do my best. It just makes it a little bit easier for my workflow. So don't send something in because you can't get it into a PDF. So if it comes down to that and you can't figure out how to turn it into a PDF, just send it to me as a photo and I'll take care of it and we'll make it work. Okay. We'll make it work for everybody. Okay. Let's go back to here. That was the PDF question. Anything else that we can address for anybody real quick before we kind of get started today? No, everybody's doing all right. Okay, I hear you guys talked about gas laws today. So who was that? Brandon was telling me that you guys did gas laws today, which is great. That's excellent because that's what we're supposed to do today too. So we're all on track. And I don't know how far you got into gas laws or how the gas laws were presented. I'm assuming that Lucas and Elizabeth present them differently. And I would probably present them differently than Lucas and Elizabeth do. So maybe a third way of presenting them and talking about them is not a bad thing in terms of reviewing. And usually I like to sort of review the gas laws and where the gas laws come from in sort of a more intuitive approach of how do we arrive at those gas laws. So that's kind of where I thought I would start today, was with an overview of gas laws before jumping into our actual experiment and then showing you how we would do that experiment that we were gonna do today. And today's experiment is super cool too, because it's the first experiment that we do where we actually calculate out the molar mass of a material. Usually when you're doing the molar mass, okay, Sarah is saying they talked about PV equals NRT. Perfect. I'm going to actually derive PV equals NRT for you. So we'll try that. We'll see how that goes. Usually when we want to calculate the molar mass of a gas or a molar mass of any material, we look at the periodic table and we take the molar masses off the periodic table. But where did they get those molar masses? How did they figure out what the molar mass of a gas is when they didn't have a periodic table? That's what today's experiment does, is works from the gas laws and allows us to be able to actually measure the molar mass of a gas without ever using a periodic table. And that's a pretty cool experiment, just from the power of that experiment alone, to be able to use gas laws to measure the molar mass of a gas itself without calculating it from the periodic table. So that's what we were going to do today. So let's start with the gas laws and look at how we can actually derive the gas laws and where the gas laws come from. So let me go and grab some images that I was drawing earlier. And I want to take these guys. This is my apparatus for doing gas laws. And this apparatus allows me to do several experiments. And what we're going to do is we're going to put a gas into this container, and then we're going to change some of the variables on it. And we have several different things that we can change. We have a movable piston. So this piston is allowed to go up and down, or we're able to lock it in place so that it can't change. So we can change this movable piston. And what that does is that works on the volume. So this allows us to be able to look at volume. And the valve that's down here, the valve at the bottom of this thing allows me to put gases in or out. So if I put gases in or out, that's going to change the number of moles in the amount of gas that I have. And the temperature, that's over here. And the pressure, those two devices are over here, and we'll be able to change temperature by adding heat. So we can either put some ice onto this thing, or we can put some heat onto this thing and we can change the temperature. We can also change the pressure, or at least we can monitor the pressure. And so what we've got now is we've got volume, moles, temperature, and pressure. And those are the four variables that we need to be able to figure out how those four variables relate to one another. And I've got a moving piston that is just sitting over here, sitting by the side so that I can use it as I need to. And the idea here is that we're going to put a gas in, we're going to hold two variables constant, and then we'll see what the effect is on the other two variables. And I like this way because as we start talking about gases, we're going to make some assumptions about gases. We're going to make what we call an ideal gas. And from that ideal gas, we'll put the ideal gas into this container. We'll hold two variables constant. We'll see how the other two variables relate, whether they relate to each other directly or indirectly, proportionally or inversely proportionally. And then we'll put them all together and show how we can actually derive PV equals NRT and how these volume, moles, temperature, and pressure are all interrelated together for gases. So that's kind of the whole idea of how we go about it. So let's take this apparatus and we'll copy it and we'll go and start our first experiment. So this isn't the experiment that we were going to do today. This is just a segue into that to review the gas laws so that we understand the gas laws. And then we'll look at how we're actually going to do the experiment that I want to do today. So, and by the way, at any point, stop me if you have questions about what it is that we're trying to do here. Actually, I'm going to leave the temperature and pressure thing there because that helps to know where those gauges are. And now I can take and I can move this guy over a little bit. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to fill this up with a gas. And we're going to put gas particles in here. And the gas is free to move about in all directions. And so these gases are moving in different directions. And as they collide with things, they bounce off. And they may trade speed. And they may trade energy in terms as they collide. And we're going to make several assumptions about these gases. So here's some beginning assumptions. And these are for our ideal gas. We're going to assume that they, number one, travel in straight lines. Unless they hit something. In which case they'll just bounce off and change direction. And what that is assuming is that they're unaffected by gravity. That's what we're saying here, is they're unaffected by gravity. We're also saying, in that they're traveling in straight lines, in that there is no intermolecular attractive forces, that the molecules are moving so fast that the intermolecular attractive forces are overwhelmed. And so we're going to say no intermolecular attractive forces. These things aren't true, but these are assumptions that we are going to make, which is going to make it into an ideal gas that allows us to more easily compare the different properties of the gases. So these are just some assumptions that we make. The next thing is that collisions, when molecules collide, they will bounce off trading energy so that slow ones, when they hit a fast one, will speed up. And fast ones, when they hit something slow, when they hit something that is going slower than they are, will transfer energy, and they themselves will slow down. So energy is transferred in collisions. The other thing that we're going to say is that these are point masses. By point mass, what we're saying is that the gas essentially has no volume, or that the particles themselves have no volume. Also not true, but helps in terms of the assumptions that we need to make. So it takes the size of a gas out, and what that does is the mass of the gas is important, but the size of the gas particle is not important. And these, all of these assumptions, what they allow us to do is they allow us to say that all gases are pretty much equal except in their mass. So because the size doesn't matter, we can treat all different gases regardless of their size equally. The fact that they travel in straight lines until they hit something and then they bounce off and they're unaffected by gravity and there's no intermolecular attractive forces means that I don't have to worry about whether a gas is polar or nonpolar. I don't have to worry about the strength of the intermolecular attractive forces because the gases are moving so fast that those intermolecular attractive forces are so weak that they're almost not important. Again, these are assumptions that are not true, but they're simplifications allowing us to call a gas an ideal gas and come up with some rules for this ideal gas, which turns out to be a pretty good model for almost all gases. So these are the assumptions that we're going to make. And that's what we're going to call an ideal gas. And the other thing is that these gases are moving extremely fast at room temperature. So on average, an N2 molecule at room temp is moving close to 500 miles per hour. So that and oxygen moving pretty much the same. They're moving incredibly fast. So when we think about a gas particle and just sort of this lazy gas particle that is hanging out and moving and diffusing, it's not really true. They're moving extraordinarily fast. Because they're so small and because their mass is so tiny and the amount of energy at 25 degrees Celsius is fairly large, that these gas particles have a large amount of momentum for these small, tiny particles. And they're moving extraordinarily fast, 500 miles per hour on average for gas particles that are moving around in the atmosphere. But they're so tiny that when they hit you, that you don't feel anything because their masses are so tiny that the momentum, it's like a bumblebee hitting a Mack truck. The Mack truck really doesn't even feel the bumblebee because even though that bee or that truck may be moving at 60 miles an hour, when the bee hits it, it just splats on the windshield because the truck is so much more massive. So we don't feel the gas particles in that way, even though they're traveling so extraordinarily fast. Okay, so let's take our apparatus here that I've got these particles in. I'm going to move it to a new page because now I need some space to actually do what we want to do. And we're going to investigate some different factors. Let's look at number one. Let's look at I always forget which one I want to do first. We can do, let's do pressure and volume. And what we'll do is we will hold temperature and the number of moles constant. So in order to do that, what we're going to do is we're going to take and release this pin. So we're going to take the pin out. And then what we're going to do is we're going to change the volume. We're going to push and put a pressure, apply a pressure onto this system, pushing this piston down. And then we're going to ask, what happens to the pressure down here? So we're going to look at the pressure gauge, and I apologize, my dogs are very barky today for some reason. We're going to look at what happens to the pressure gauge when I push that piston down. So I'm going to paste this in a second time and see if I can move this whole piston. And I don't know how this is going to go when I go to try to do this. Let's try it. Oh, it grabbed everything. So let me delete out some of these things that I don't need and then reset a little bit. And of course, our locking pin is gone. Okay, now I can grab this and bring it down and look at what happens to it when I push that piston down. And you can think about this almost like a bicycle pump. That essentially what we're doing is we're pushing down on a piston and we're watching what happens as we push down on that piston to the pressure gauge. And so this whole piston is going to move. This is the tricky part. I don't know if I can catch the whole thing. I'll get most of it. And we'll bring it all down. And as we bring it down, what happens to the gas is the gas gets condensed into a smaller space. So I have the same number of gas particles that I had before, but now there's a whole lot more of them crammed into a much smaller volume. And the pressure gauge, when I look at the pressure gauge, the pressure increases. So the new reading on the gauge goes up and the pressure has increased. So we were sitting over here, and now our pressure gauge is increased. So what we've seen is that when we push down on that piston, volume decreases, volume goes down, but pressure goes up. And I think it's not enough to say that the pressure goes up. I think it's important to understand why the pressure went up. What was it that actually happened or changed just by cramming more gas particles in here? What actually changed that allowed the pressure to go up? Well, if we take any sort of square inch and we look at a square inch inside this container, then what we see is that, we'll just take a square inch here, 1 inch by 1 inch. As the particles collide with this square inch and bounce back off it, each particle that collides with that exerts a pressure on the wall. So if I think about the number of particles that are colliding with the wall, and I look at that over time, and I integrate it over time, then the number of particles that hit the wall impart a force to it, and I can measure that as pressure per square inch. And if I think of that pressure in terms of pounds, I can measure it in pounds per square inch. So if I take and I look at sort of a square inch over here on the wall, and I look at the number of collisions that are occurring to that square inch initially, when the particles are really diffuse, there are less collisions with the square inch over a given period of time. And I'll call it with unit area, because that's really what it is that we're looking at a unit area. And so for any given unit of area, there are less collisions per unit of time when the gas is more diffuse. As the gas gets concentrated on the right-hand side by decreasing the volume, then what happens is the number of collisions per unit area goes up. More collisions, equals more force. And more force is a higher pressure. More force per unit area equals higher pressure. Well, what does that mean in terms of volume and pressure, and how are volume and pressure related? Well, what we find is that if we do it this way and we say, okay, volume, we'll use V for volume. Volume is going down, but pressure is going up. These two are what are called inversely proportional. And that inversely proportional concept means that if I take P, P is equal to 1 over V. So as the volume goes down, the pressure goes up. And instead of putting equals there, it's not really equals, it's proportional to. So we'll use that symbol. This symbol means proportional to. So it doesn't mean equal, it's not an equality. It just means that they trend opposite, and proportional just meaning that they're going to trend in some way together. And so we're finding that the pressure is inversely proportional to the volume. As pressure goes up, volume goes down. As pressure goes down, volume goes up. That's how they're related to one another. We're going to do this for a couple more variables. And what we're going to do is, and I'm not sure where I want to do it, we'll tally these at the last page. Usually on the whiteboard, when I do it in the class, I keep a running total of each one of these proportionalities that I find. And then we bring all those proportionalities together at the end of class and make them into one equation and show how they kind of fit together. But we'll do that at the end, and we'll pick a page at the end and do that. For now, let's go and do our next experiment and see if we can relate pressure to some of the other things, like maybe temperature. Let's go see what we can do. So we'll grab our apparatus again. This time I'm going to try to grab just the pieces that I need rather than the whole thing. And we'll start a new page down here. So we've got our apparatus. And this time what I want to try to do is look at how pressure is related to temperature. So we'll investigate pressure versus temperature. And we'll keep moles and volume constant. So by keeping moles and volume constant, what we're basically doing is we're keeping this locking pin in place and we're keeping the valve closed. So both of those things are closed, and that's where my moles and volume, that's how they're being kept constant, is by those things being locked in place. And we're going to put our particles in here again for the gas. So we've got a bunch of gas particles just spaced around. And they're doing their thing, moving in all different directions and colliding and grooving. And what we're going to do is we're going to increase the temperature and then see what the effect is on the pressure. So one of the easiest ways to increase the temperature on the system is to put a flame underneath it. So we'll just put a candle under here, and we'll heat it up. So as we heat up this system, then, and we can go through and we can grab this whole thing minus the flame. We'll take the gauges with us. We'll copy it, paste it over here. And what we need to do is each one of these particles is now hotter. So I'm going to grab all the particles and I'm going to style them now in red, because where they were moving in different directions before rather slowly, and they were colliding off the walls and doing their different things, now what they're doing is they're moving with much greater speed, because as we increase temperature, temperature actually is an increase in speed in molecular motion. So the faster a particle is moving, the hotter it is. That was actually one of the assumptions that I should have written down before too, is that speed is directly proportional to temperature. So that the faster a particle is moving, the hotter it is, or I should say the hotter a particle is, the faster it is moving. That was part of actually our molecular kinetic theory that is usually discussed in the beginning of Chem 3. So it's one of the first topics that we discuss, which is molecular kinetic theory, which relates temperature and the rate at which a particle is moving. So that's not specific to gases. That's true of all particles, that the hotter they are, the faster they move. So as these particles are moving faster now, then what I can do is I can look and say, well, let's take that image of the wall. And I had my little sort of square inch that I was interested in, and looking at what's happening collision-wise in a square inch. And as I heat this thing up, one consequence of the particles moving faster is that there are more frequent collisions, that the particles are just colliding with more frequency because they are moving faster. So as particles move faster, we have more collisions per unit time. With more collisions per unit time, more collisions equals more force. The other thing is that each collision is actually stronger because the particles are moving faster, they have more momentum. Each collision is actually stronger, which also increases force. So faster particles equal more forceful collisions or stronger collisions. Each of these things mean that there is an increase in the force per unit area. And that means that that's an increase in pressure. So as we increase temperature, as temperature went up, then we found that the pressure also went up. And conversely, if we cool it down, the pressure will go down. So what we find is that these two are what are called directly proportional. As temperature goes up, pressure goes up. As temperature goes down, pressure goes down. And they are directly proportional to one another. So what I need to do here is I also need to say, all right, let's go back and just catch our little diagram here, that we had the original temperature, which was pointed sort of in this direction, and we now have an increase in our temperature, and we also have an increase in our pressure. So as we heated it all up, temperature went up, pressure went up, directly proportional relationship. Again, go ahead and stop me any point if you have any question about how I'm making these assumptions. I'm not seeing anything in the chat. I wanted to just check real quick and see. Everybody seems like they're doing okay and they're following along. All right, and is this along the lines of what Elizabeth did or Lucas did? I don't know if they did this, probably not. They probably just gave you the relationships, but they may have. All right, let's go grab another. Like I said, each of us as instructors have our unique ways of presenting different materials. And so I think getting as many different points of view of how the materials are presented are only going to benefit you, because some people may find Elizabeth's way of presenting things much more to their liking and may find that that resonates with them and they understand it better. Lucas has his own way. Maybe people find that way better. And maybe some people find my way better. So I don't know. So having different people explain it in different ways only adds to your learning, I think. And so that's why I think it's worth it to sit and go over this again. Okay, let's do another one. So we've done pressure versus temperature. And we've done pressure versus volume. I think the next thing that we ought to do is pressure versus number of moles. So let's do the next one here. And we'll do pressure versus number of moles. Oops, that was an image, not what I wanted. Let's try that again. I like the one that is editable that I can move around. Okay, so now what we're going to do is, see if I can get those things out of the way. We're going to investigate pressure versus moles. And we're going to hold temperature and volume constant. That's not cool. What did it do? There we go. So in order to do that, what we're going to do is we're going to open the valve down here. So we're going to take this pin out of the valve, and we're actually going to hook up a gas tank to it. And I've got a gas tank somewhere over here that I don't have to redraw. You can see I've been having fun drawing lately. Let's hook up our gas tank, and we'll pump the gas into here. And we'll just throw some more gas into it. So we're going to add gas to it. Add gas moles. And we're going to do this rather slowly so that we don't change the temperature. We're going to allow the temperature to stay constant by doing this in a slow process. If we add the gas in really, really fast, then the temperature goes up and a bunch of different things happen. But if we do it slowly enough, then we can allow the temperature to bleed off and to stay constant. And then we don't have to take that into account. And the volume, the pin is going to be in there. So that's going to be locked in place. So what we do is we just add more gas into this. And as we add more gas, we'll take the apparatus and grab this whole thing. And as we add gas, the number of moles just goes up. And we get a lot more particles, all moving at the same rate of speed. But we just have a lot more. We've just increased the amount of gas that's inside the container. So as we increase the number of particles, then for any given unit area that we decide to look at on the wall, we could calculate how many collisions we see for that unit area. And what we should see is, because there's many more gas particles, we should see more collisions. And as we see more collisions, then the pressure should go up, right? Because that's how we're relating things. So as, and we'll lock this back in here again. So as more gas particles are added, the number of collisions goes up. As the number of collisions go up, then number of collisions is proportional to the pressure itself for the unit area. And so the pressure goes up. And so what we find is that as pressure goes up, the number of moles goes up, and we'll use N to represent moles. So moles goes up, pressure goes up, and that means that these two are directly proportional to one another. So we've discovered another proportionality, that these are directly proportional. Okay, let's just take those three experiments and see what we can do with those three experiments. So what we've said so far is that combining those three things, we have that the pressure is inversely proportional to the volume. We have that the pressure is directly proportional to the temperature. And we have that the pressure is directly proportional to the number of moles. So this gets all four variables on the page in a way that allows me to be able to add these proportionalities and say, all right, well, the pressure is proportional to the number of moles times the temperature and inversely proportional to the volume. And this proportionality is a problem because it's not an equality. So how can I get an equality? Well, one of the ways that I can get an equality is that if I take these things and I put them on a graph and I investigate the relationship by changing a lot of the different variables and graphing each one of those variables together in one big graph and look and see what we get. So what we're going to do is we're going to take and make a graph. And on the y-axis, we're going to do pressure. And on the x-axis, we're going to do NT over V. And when we plot all these points, and we do this for many different gases, and we do it for many different temperatures, many different volumes, many different pressures, we just vary all the variables within this system, and we plot all the different points we can, and we do it for a number of different gases. So what we find is that when we plot all these, we get a number of different things, and we'll do it for a couple of different gases. So we can do different colors here for different gases, that we find that when we plot them, and then we do an assessment of averaging them all out, that we find that they all travel fairly along the same line, and that that line is a straight line. And because it's a straight line, that means that the formula for a straight line is y equals mx plus b. And so if I think about what's on the y-axis here, what's on the y-axis is p, and that is equal to some slope times x, and my slope is m, and my x is nt over v. And then I have my y-intercept that I gotta worry about as well, b. But because if the number of moles goes to zero, or the temperature goes to zero, the pressure goes to zero, the intercept is zero, which means that I can throw out the b here because b, in this case, is equal to zero. That's where my intercept is. And then I can measure what that slope is. And the slope of that equation, m, when it's measured, is equal to 0.0821. And the units of my pressure were in atmospheres. And the units of my slope over here were in moles, not my slope, but my x-axis were in moles times Kelvin, because that's what I measured temperature in, over liters, that's what I measured volume in. And so the units of this slope, rise over run, are in atmospheres, liter atmospheres per mole Kelvin. So I need to change back in here. This is going to be liters atmospheres over moles Kelvin. And that's what M equals. And so when I put all that together and I give M a new name and I decide to call M the universal gas constant, and I give it a new variable, we call it R, so that R is equal to M is equal to the 0.0821 liter atmospheres per mole Kelvin, and we call that the universal gas constant, all that gives me an equation now that becomes P equals R, the universal gas constant, times NT over V, and that's my equation for my straight line. And what we decide to do is we decide to then move the volume to the other side of the equation, just to make the equation look like a single equation on a single line rather than having a denominator. So we multiply both sides of the equation by v, just to move that v to the other side so that we cancel it out. And what we wind up getting is the equation, which is PV equals nRT, just rearranging it. And the reason that we rearrange it is because it sounds better. nRT just kind of rattles off your tongue in a nice, easy way. PV equals nRT. And what we have done is through the measurement and using the straight line relationship, we were able to get rid of the proportionality and make it an equality. And so what R is a proportionality constant, is really what that is. And that proportionality constant is derived from many, many different experiments where I measure the number of moles, temperature, volume, and the pressure, plot them all on a slope and get a straight line and measure that slope. And that is the proportionality constant. So that's how I get rid of the proportionality and make it into an equality. And we give that value a name, which is the universal gas constant. So R is nothing more than a proportionality constant. It's experimentally derived. We should say measured rather than derived, because that's what it is. And R is equal to 0.0821 liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin. Those are the units that we're using. And it fits into the equation in that PV equals nRT, and this is our ideal gas law. And that ideal gas law can be derived, as we have shown, from three simple thought experiments using an apparatus where you can control all the different variables and just looking at what happens when you change two of those variables and keep the other two constant, bringing those all together. And then we would have to do some experiments. We couldn't get the value of R just through the thought experiment. That has to be done through actual experimentation. But we can actually show the process of how PV equals nRT is derived and where it comes from. And now that we understand it, now we can go through and we can actually use PV equals nRT to do a couple of computations. Okay, how are we doing so far? Everybody with me? Cool. Okay. So, maybe I should ask, or maybe I don't need to ask. Maybe we just need to actually look at an ideal gas laws problem. So how do we do a problem in ideal gas laws? Let's say that we have a problem that is a container at 25 degrees Celsius has a volume of 0.75 liters, and contains 0.023 grams of nitrogen gas. And we'll put nitrogen gas as N2. What is the pressure in the container? So whenever I do an ideal gas laws problem, I always like to list out all my variables, P, V, N, R, and T. And then I start pulling them out of the problem and just write them down. So pressure is my question mark. I don't know what it is. Volume, 0.75 liters. I've got that one. Number of moles. I don't know the number of moles. They didn't give it to me. But what they did give me is they gave me 0.023 grams. And that's of nitrogen gas. R is the gas constant, and that's something that needs to be memorized. 0.0821 2-1, liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin. And always keeping the units with everything is also really critically important. And temperature was in 25 degrees C. Okay, let's look at R for a second. R was 0.0821. This is 3 sig figs. It's a measured quantity, so we need to make sure that we understand that we're using it to 3 sig figs. That's the first thing. And then liters, atmospheres, over moles, Kelvin. These units of R are critical such that when I look at liters over here, that I need to make sure that if I'm going to use R, that my volume needs to be in the same number of liters, or it needs to be in the same unit of liters, or I can't use R as my proportionality constant. So we need to make sure that the units match the units of R before we proceed. We are in grams, we can't be in grams. The number of moles needs to actually be measured in terms of moles. So we're going to have to convert that into moles in order to be able to work. The other thing is that I've got temperature in degrees C, but temperature is required to be in Kelvin. So I've got to do some unit conversions before I can use my proportionality constant to actually calculate out what P is. So we'll go through and we'll do those quick conversions to figure out what those things are. So degrees Celsius converting into Kelvin, what I need to do is add 273.15, and that will convert me into Kelvin. So this is going to come out to 298.15. So you also need to remember your temperature conversions. That's going to be a critical thing in order to be able to do these gas laws problems. So now I'm in the right unit of measure. I'm in Kelvin. The number of moles, I'm going to have to do a mole conversion. So nitrogen weighs 14. So if I look at nitrogen, nitrogen equals 14.01 grams per mole. In order to figure out N2, N2 equals 2 times 14.01, or that's going to equal 28.02 grams per mole. So I'll do my unit conversion saying that this is 28.02 grams of N2 for every 1 mole of N2. And we'll get that number real quick. I didn't have this thought out, so we're doing it on the fly. 0.023 divided by 28.02, and that's going to be 8.208. I'm going to let the sig figs run long. I said 208 and I wrote 28. 208 times 10 to the minus 4 moles of N2. All right, so now I've got moles. I've done all my unit conversions. And things got a little bit tight in here because I hadn't anticipated how much space I was going to actually require. So we're going to bring this down and just make the notes a little cleaner so that when you guys go back and look at them later, they're not so confusing and so tight. Always saving enough room for your work is a great practice. Okay, so now that I've done that, now I can take and I can plug PV equals nRT and solve it for pressure. And so as I solve it for pressure, I'll divide both sides by the volume and I get pressure is equal to nRT over V. Now that I've rearranged the equation, now I can put my values into it. Never put the values in and then rearrange. Always rearrange with the variables and then put the values in. It's so much easier to do and you make so many less mistakes when you rearrange the equation mathematically first and then go back and put the values in. So my number of moles are 8.208 times 10 to the minus 4 moles. And that's in my calculator right now. And I'm going to leave it there and I'm just going to use it as its entire thing so I don't create any roundoff error. The next thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to put in here my R value, 0.0821. liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin. And then we'll also put in our temperature at 298.15 Kelvin and our volume which was at 0.75 liters. And we'll check our units really quickly. So liters here is going to cancel with the liters there. Moles will cancel with the denominator there. Kelvin will cancel with there. And I'm going to wind up with atmospheres in my numerator. And that is a unit of pressure. So I'm going to come out with the right units. And I'm also, well, let's get the number first and then we'll do sig figs. So I'm going to take 8.208 times 10 to the minus 4, multiply it times 0.0821, multiply it by 298.15, divide by 0.75, and I get a pretty small number, but I started with a small number of moles, 0.026790 atmospheres. And now we'll go through and do a sig figs check real quick. So sig figs wise, there was 2 sig figs in my volume. I had 2 sig figs that were in my number of moles that came from the original grams. So I'm going to keep only 2 of those sig figs. The rest of them were extra, but I was leaving that long so I didn't create round off error. There are 3 sig figs in your R value. And for my temperature, by the rules of addition, I get rounded off to the ones place. So there are 3 sig figs here, but the smallest is 2. So I get rounded to 2 sig figs. And this is going to round to 0.027 atmospheres. And that would be the pressure that would be in my container. Okay? How did we do? Everybody follow along with what I did there? Nice. Okay. So that's just one example of PV equals NRT. We could, given any of the three variables out of the 4, solve for the 4th variable. And it's just a matter of rearranging the equation in order to do that. The only other thing that we have is to talk about units for a minute. So let's look at units for a second. In discussing units, we already know that we need to have liters, atmospheres, over moles, Kelvin, that these are the units that we need to have. Volume must always be in liters. Any other unit of volume will need to be converted into liters. Moles, self-explanatory, it needs to be in moles. So if we're given mass, in grams, we'll need to go through the molar mass and convert into the number of moles. So that conversion is not very difficult. Temperature. Temperature is going to need to be in Kelvin. And so if we happen to be in degrees Celsius, that means that it's going to be plus 273.15. If you're given Fahrenheit, then the easiest way is to convert from Fahrenheit to Celsius and then Celsius to Kelvin. That's a much easier conversion. So to go from degrees Fahrenheit to degrees Celsius, there's a number of different equations out there. Everybody sort of memorizes a different equation, but let's see. So we take Fahrenheit, and I think I need to, I always need to go back in my head because I don't remember it this way. I always line up the rulers and think about what I need to do with the ruler. So I need to subtract 32 in order to go down to the zero point. So I need to subtract 32 degrees. And then to that, I need to multiply it by 180 degrees Fahrenheit over 100 degrees Celsius, and that'll convert me into degrees Celsius. So that's the equation to convert into degrees Celsius. And pressure is the hard one. So pressure we want in ATMs, in atmospheres, but there are many different units of pressure. There are atmospheres, there are torr, there are millimeters of mercury, there are pounds per square inch. So LBS per square inch. Sometimes we can do units of pascals. There are all different units. And fortunately, the three main units that you need to worry about are atmospheres, torrs, and millimeters of mercury. This seems to be the wheelhouse that most chemistry instructors stick within. And the fortunate thing is that torrs and millimeters of mercury are very, they're identical. I was gonna say they're very closely related. They are very closely related in that they're actually an identical unit of measure, that one torr equals 1 millimeter of mercury. So conversion factor wise, one ATM is equal to 760 millimeters of mercury, which is equal to 760 torr. And 1 millimeter of mercury is equal to 1 torr. So that we have all the conversion factors that we need. And as millimeters of mercury is worth talking about as well. So where does the unit of millimeters of mercury come from? Because that's our classic barometric reading. So the way that works is that a barometer is a device that measures pressure. And what they do is they take a very long tube and they fill this tube full of mercury. And once the tube is filled with mercury, they close it off and they upend it upside down into a pool of mercury. And the mercury, by the virtue of how dense it is and how much it weighs, pulls itself down, creating a vacuum in the top of the chamber. And what we find is that when the mercury is upside down and like this, it can't come out of the tube entirely, but that the height of the column of mercury reflects the pressure of the atmosphere. So what is pushing out here is the pressure of the atmosphere. And what is inside here is a vacuum. And the height, the distance from this point to the top of the mercury in the barometer is measured in millimeters. And that millimeters represents the millimeters of mercury. And when that column happens to be 760 millimeters tall, that is what we define as 1 atmosphere. And so as the pressure either goes up or down, pushing on that pool of mercury, it will raise the column as the pressure goes up. And so the pressure will become greater. And if the pressure of the atmosphere falls, the mercury will fall and the pressure will go down. So when you hear the weatherman talking about rising mercury or falling mercury, what they're saying is that the pressure is either going up or down by the measurement of millimeters of mercury, which is just a very simple barometric measuring device. Okay, so that's where those 760 millimeters of mercury come from, and that's where that equality comes from. Okay, that's the background that I wanna do for PV equals NRT, but I wanna give you guys a chance to ask questions before I actually sort of overview what it is that we're gonna do for our experiment, because I'm gonna do an experiment, go through, show you how we collect all the data, and then walk through one of the sample calculations and show you how we do that. But let me ask sort of how everybody's doing, or if there's any questions. I know you guys are all, you've all been following along and doing okay, but I want to give the chance to ask questions because you guys aren't stopping me. You're just kind of letting me go. What is torr? Torr is just a unit. It is named after a chemist. Torlini, I can't remember who invented the unit, but the unit of torr is essentially the same as a millimeter of mercury. They're the same unit of measure. So I don't have the historic reference behind torr. I should look that up, but I haven't done that yet. Ramiro, you asked me to go up to the other page. Is that where you needed to be? Cool. Okay, any other questions? Feel free to unmute your mic too if you want to throw out a question that is more difficult to type. If you don't want to put it into the chat, you can always hit the space bar, unmute for a second, ask your question, and or not. Maybe you guys are doing okay. All right. Then, maybe I should ask, is there anything from either Lucas's or Elizabeth's lectures about PV equals NRT that you found confusing that I could help try to clear up? Or maybe I already cleared it up in going through this lecture. And I'll remind you too, it's very easy the second time through. Things always make more sense the second time through, no matter who's presenting the information. So it's the benefit and the luxury of the second lecturer to always make things a little bit clearer, not necessarily because we make it clear, but because you're seeing it for the second time and it's easier to catch things you may have missed the first time. So, okay, let's take a look at our experiment then. So let's go down and start a new page down here. And we're going to do an experiment called the molar mass of a gas. And the purpose of this experiment is to measure, we're going to measure the properties of mass, volume, temperature, and pressure. And from these properties, we're going to calculate molar mass. And the way that we're going to do that is we could take the two equations. We could take PV equals NRT. So that's equation number one. And we can take equation number two, which says that molar mass is equal to the mass divided by the number of moles. And this is for the same gas. So we're dealing with one gas here, and we're looking at the measurements of the pressure, the volume, the number of moles, the temperature. And what we're after, what we'd like to be able to calculate out here is the molar mass. Okay, so we need to find some way of combining these two equations. And so how do I combine these two equations? What variable do these two equations have in common? The variable that they have in common happens to be the number of moles. Remember that moles in the gas laws is represented with the lowercase n. And in molar mass, we've never used a variable to represent moles before, but we've just written it out as moles. But in essence, moles is n. And so we can take equation two and we can say that molar mass is equal to the mass of a gas divided by the number of moles of that gas. And we can solve this for n and we could substitute it into equation one. So that's what we're going to do. So let's solve this equation and substitute it into equation one. So what we get is N is equal to mass divided by molar mass. And now when we take that and we plug that into equation one, we had PV equals NRT. Equation one is going to become PV is equal to mass times RT all over molar mass. And we've completed the substitution, and what we want to now solve for is we want to solve for that molar mass. And so what we'll do is we'll move molar mass to the left-hand side of the equation, and we'll get molar mass times PV is equal to the mass times RT. And if I move PV to the other side, I get molar mass is equal to the mass of a gas times R times T, all divided by pressure and volume. And so now I have an equation for molar mass, which gives me mass over times R times T over PV. Let's check the units really quick on that. Let's see what those units are coming out to. Mass is in grams. R is in liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin. And temperature is going to be in Kelvin. Pressure was in atmospheres. And volume was in liters. So as I go through and I start canceling units, Kelvin will cancel Kelvin. Liters will cancel the liters in the numerator here. Atmospheres will cancel the atmospheres in the numerator. And what I'm left with is grams divided by moles. So this comes out to grams divided by moles. And isn't that grams per mole? Isn't that molar mass? So we found an equation that allows us to be able to calculate molar mass if we can measure the different variables that need to be measured. We need to measure the mass of a gas, we need to measure the temperature of the gas, the volume of the gas, and the pressure of the gas. Measure those four things, put them into the equation, and we can measure the molar mass of the gas. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take all this equipment, and this is the equipment that would have come in the kit. And we're going to go over and see what we can do with this. I think that fits on my screen. All right, so the equipment that would have come, that we would have been doing this experiment with, is we would have started with an Erlenmeyer flask. This is a 250 milliliter Erlenmeyer flask. We would have had a 1,000 milliliter beaker, so this is a 1 liter beaker. This would have been 1,000 milliliters. We would have had a gas tank that would have had a gas unlabeled, would have been labeled, but we're gonna assume that it's unlabeled right now. We would have had a pan balance to measure mass on, a ring stand, a ring to be able to connect to that. We've had a rubber stopper, a thermometer to measure temperatures with, and then this rubber tubing to help us get the gas in where it needs to go, and a scupula, which comes in handy for getting rid of the rubber stopper, removing the rubber stopper once we go to do the experiment. So the first thing is, when we want to measure all these different properties, some of these properties are going to be more difficult to measure than others. And we're going to have to talk about each step of the way, some differences in how we're approaching taking the measurements. We're going to set up the apparatus this way. So all these things get combined together. And the first thing that we do is we take this Erlenmeyer flask and we fill it full of water, and we completely fill it so that there's no air bubbles in it. And as we fill it up with water, we're gonna put a stopper in it. That is not gonna help me. Let's see, let's go to that. So we fill this up until there's water that's just coming out of the top of it. And we're really careful about getting all the air bubbles out. And once we get all the air bubbles out of it, then what we do is we put that stopper in it. So we go and we grab our stopper and we plug this guy into it. And then we take the entire thing and we turn it upside down. And once we turn it upside down, that's what goes into this ring stand over here. And we set it into the ring stand. And we set it into the ring stand with the stopper in it included. And then the idea behind this scupula is that once it's upside down in the beaker, it's really hard to get the stopper out. And so the scoopula allows us to take and to poke at that stopper, and we just kind of wedge the stopper off by pushing on it and pushing in several different directions. And when that stopper is upside down into here, the stopper just kind of falls out, and the water doesn't come out because it's held in by the vacuum or the force of vacuum that's created inside the beaker. So when you're working with this thing, the stopper is kind of sitting down here in the bottom, is falling down into the bottom of the beaker. And then we take that long tubing that has the glass U-tube on the bottom, and we hook it up to the gas canister, and we're going to put gas into this thing. But before we put gas into it, one of the critical things is that we measure the mass of the gas tank first, so that, number one, we set up the apparatus, we fill the flask with water, we invert into the beaker full of water. Actually, about 700 milliliters of water. We got to save a little bit of room so we don't entirely fill the beaker. And then number three, we're going to measure the mass of the gas. We're going to measure the mass of the gas tank itself. So when we measure the mass of the gas tank, these tanks usually weigh something in the range of 826.2 grams. So this is going to be mass tank. And we'll put a little I down here because that's initial, or we can actually use a capital I. Or actually, here's a better even symbol than gas initial. Is we use a little not symbol for the initial, and then we'll use an F for final. So we just put the gas tank on the balance and we get the mass of the tank itself. And I had my little balance over there, which, oh, it was so prettily drawn, but I don't need to use it. You understand what we're doing here. Next thing that we do is we dispense some gas into the flask. So we use the U-tube to put gas into the flask, displacing the water. So as we put that gas in, what winds up happening is the gas starts to, let's see, how do I need to do this? Let's do it this way. The gas starts to displace water, and the water comes out of this thing and starts to fill up the beaker. So all this water is coming out, and we keep going and adding gas to it with little bubbles. This is the hard piece to erase. I'm just gonna erase all this. It's gonna look better anyway. And we go until the water is just about in the straight part of the neck of the flask. So we want to go all the way and fill it with gas right about to there. And then we want to stop. We want to make sure that we don't actually get all the water out of the flask. It's important that when we're putting the gas in the tank, that we stop. Ooh, wrong pin size. Stop when water is in the tapered section. Don't remove all the water. That's a critical thing. So after we do that, then we reweigh the flask, the gas tank again. So let's say that our gas tank is going to weigh, it's going to weigh 825.5, 0.6 grams. So the mass of the tank final equals 825.6 grams. Okay, so between the two weighings, we now know how much gas got delivered into the apparatus. So the amount of gas that we're working with, the difference between the masses equals the mass of the gas. So I've got 800, what do we start with? 26.2. And we're subtracting 825.6. 826.2, subtract 825.6. And I've got, it came out to, that can't be right. Maybe it is right. It's 0.06. 0.60 grams. We'll say that we had two decimal places there. So that's the mass. That equals the mass of my gas that I put into this apparatus. So in my equation, let's remind ourselves what the equation was. It was that the molar mass was equal to the mass times RT over P and V. And we've got the mass. We've got the first variable that we needed. Now let's go take a look at the temperature as the second variable that we need. So in getting the temperature turns out to be a little bit harder to get because the thermometer is straight. We don't have a thermometer that's got a bend in it. So I have to get kind of creative in how I'm going to measure the actual temperature of this thing. Let's take our thermometer and see if I can rotate it and place it into our solution. So by putting the thermometer into the water, what's happening at the water surface and the gas surface inside the flask, if I could blow up what's happening inside the flask. So this is sort of an inside view. This is my water surface and the flask walls. And I've got all this water that is in here. And the water molecules that are inside here are moving at a particular speed, maybe moving fairly slowly because they're in a liquid state. And the gas particles that are point masses, these guys are coming down and colliding and bouncing back off. And so while they may have been fairly hot and hitting this solution fairly hot, as they come off, they cool down. They're trading energy. And eventually, given enough time, all of the gas particles will have the same energy as the water because they will entirely trade energy until they are all moving at essentially the same speed. Remember that the gas particles are moving at around 500 miles per hour for room temperature. So particles that are moving 500 miles per hour are not going to take very long to actually collide with the water molecules and fully equilibrate such that the temperature of the gas will be the same as the temperature of the water. Does that make sense? If we just wait long enough, so we put the thermometer inside the water and we wait 1 minute and or 2 minutes or 5 minutes, and then we measure the temperature, and the temperature that is in the water should be exactly the same as the temperature of the gas, given enough time to equilibrate. So that's how we're going to get the temperature. So let's record our temperature, and we'll say that here, number 7, we measure the temp. Measure the temp of the water. And that if we give it long enough, that's going to be the same as the temp of the gas. And so we've got temperature. And let's say that our temperature is like 21.2 degrees Celsius. So that's where our temperature of our water was. Next, we've got to get volume and pressure. Volume and pressure are more difficult to be able to get. And so we need to look at a couple of different scenarios in order to be able to measure volume and pressure. And let's talk about the pressure first before we talk about the volume. So I want to go and grab another image. Actually, is this the one I want? Yeah, let's do this. Actually, I want both of these. When we go to measure pressure, we have the flask inverted into the water. And it's being held in place. It's not as easy to rotate that as one might think. Okay, so we'll set it inside here. And we're going to take this image and we're going to make three of them. Because there's three different possibilities in terms of measuring the pressure and what's going on with inside the pressure. Inside the flask, there is water inside the flask. And that water is sitting down in here. And there's also water that is inside the beaker. And so that water is all inside here. And so I've got the two different water levels that I've got to be concerned with. And there's three different possible ways that this could look. It could look the way that I've drawn it now, or it could look that the two levels are identical in the same location. We'll draw that like that. Or it could be that the water level inside the flask is lower than the water outside in the beaker. This one's a little bit harder to draw. I think I can do it if I just do it with shading. We say, all right, there's the level inside the flask and the rest of it is filled with air. Okay, so when we think about what's pushing out here, like the mercury barometer, this is the pressure of the atmosphere, which is pushing on the water. And what is pushing inside the flask is the pressure of the gas, but it's not the pressure of the gas alone. There's two gases that are inside the beaker. When we look inside the beaker or the flask, anytime you have a pool of water, and you're measuring something over a pool of water, water particles are evaporating out of this and leaving to become a gas. So we get water in its gas state. And this is water that was in its liquid state. So anytime you measure anything over the top of water, there is always the water pressure, the partial pressure of the water itself that has to be taken into account when measuring. So inside this flask, there is not only the gas, there is also the pressure of water. And those two things combined are what are pushing down on the inside. So it is true that I have the pressure of the gas plus the pressure of the water pushing down on here. And outside, I have the pressure of the atmosphere. And that's pushing on the water there. And inside here, I also have the pressure of the gas plus water. And outside here, I have the pressure of the atmosphere. Okay, so in the first scenario, in scenario number one, or let's call this A, in A, the pressures are such that the pressure of the gas is greater than the pressure of the atmosphere. The pressure of the atmosphere is greater than the pressure of the gas plus the pressure of the water. In C, the last one, the pressure of the gas and water is greater than the pressure of the atmosphere. And in B, the one in the center, they're equal. So the question is, where do I want to measure the pressure? Do I want to measure the pressure where it is greater, less than, or equal to the pressure of my gas plus the pressure of the water? And the answer is that you want to measure it here. You want to measure it at B. You want to measure with them where they're equal, because the pressure of the gas is actually linked to the pressure of the atmosphere. And if it's greater or less, I don't know how much greater or how much less it is. But if I make them equal, and the way that I make them equal is I simply grab the flask and I move the flask up and down. And as I move the flask up and down, these two levels go up and down. And so I adjust the level of the flask so that the level of the water inside and the level of the water outside are equal. And then I use a little Sharpie pen, and I go in here with a little pen and I put a little mark on my flask right there with the Sharpie pen, with a black Sharpie. And that tells me where the level of the water was marked. So we put a mark right here on the flask. And then we take the flask out, and now we can fill the flask with water. That is not going to give me what I want. I need my flask over here that's got my mark on it. And, oh, I failed to draw an image. I didn't draw a graduated cylinder. What we do is we take the flask now that has its Sharpie mark on it. And so we say that we've got a little mark right here. And we fill with water to the mark. And then we measure it using a graduated cylinder. And the graduated cylinder is just a straight measuring device for measuring volumes. You guys have used them enough times. They've got all the marks on it. And we pour the water into here and we just measure the volume. So now we've got the volume and we've sort of got the pressure. So this is a little check for the pressure, because we're going to talk about pressure a little bit more. So we've adjusted the volumes. We made our mark. We've measured our volume. And our volume was on the range of 237 milliliters. So let's say that the volume equaled 237 milliliters that we got there out of that. And now we need to talk about the pressure. So the pressure is our next thing. So volume and pressure were kind of measured together. And for the pressure, we know that the pressure of the atmosphere is equal to the pressure of the gas plus the pressure of the water. This is actually what's called Dalton's law of partial pressures. Dalton's law says that the pressure of a system total is equal to pressure one plus pressure two plus however many pressures there are, all the pressures added together add to the sum total of the pressure. So we have the pressure of the atmosphere is equal to the pressure of the gas plus the pressure of the water. And if we take and we rearrange this equation, we can get that the pressure of the gas is equal to the pressure of the atmosphere minus the pressure of the water. Well, the pressure of the atmosphere can be found by just measuring the atmospheric pressure today. So we can look at the atmospheric pressure on a barometer and measure what the pressure is. So this is measured using a barometer. Except you got to spell it right. Okay, and let's say that that barometric pressure was equal to 752.56 millimeters of mercury. So when we measured the barometric pressure, that's what we got today. And the pressure of the water, this is a factor of temperature. It's related to temp. And there are tables that we can use in order to figure out what the barometric pressure is. So in the lab that we had today, and I need to go grab it. So let me, I have the lab up. I just need to grab the pressure. And let me think about how I want to grab that. I need to do a screenshot. Give me 1 second here while I... figure out how I'm gonna get this over to where I need to get it so that you guys can see it. I need to find a utility that I have that allows me to just take a picture of it, but I can't find it. Oh, and my dogs are gonna go off and go crazy. Screenshot, that's what I want. Still not helping me. Almost there. Oh, I'm having technology problems. Almost got it. Capture. All right. Sweet. Now I can share this and you guys can see what I was doing. Sorry that took me so long. This needs to go into Notability and add to the note and import and done and back to Notability and we should have it in here. Okay. This is a table of vapor pressures of water related to temperature. And so what we need to do, or what we're doing at this point, is to take the temperature of water that we had and to find where that temperature of water is. So our temperature of water was what, 22? We're going to go back and find that piece of data, 21.2 degrees Celsius. So here was our temperature of water that we recorded. And we'll put all this data all into one spot in a second so that we've got it all set together, 21.2 degrees Celsius. So we come down on our chart and we find 21.2 degrees Celsius. It's right in here and we're right at 18.6 torr. So those are our units, was torr. And we could extrapolate. So we could figure out we were 21.2. That means that we're going to be about 18.8 because it's about 10 units in between. So we're going to be about 18.8 torr for the vapor pressure of water. So when we come back up here, this is related to temp and found on table. And we're finding that this is 18.8. Extrapolating torr. And so now we have our barometric pressure, we have our water, we have our volume, we have all our measurements. Let's consolidate all those measurements into one spot and we'll go get them all. So we'll make a list of the different measurements that we're going to have. We have mass that is going to be in grams. We have volume. We have pressure, which is of the atmosphere. We have the pressure of the water. We have the temperature. And volume, pressure, temperature, that's everything that we had. So our mass, let's go back and get it, was 0.60 grams. Sorry for me sliding around so much. I don't know any other way to do it at this point when I've got data thrown all over the place. Our volume was 237 milliliters. Our pressure of our atmosphere was 752.56 millimeters of mercury, 752.56 millimeters of mercury. And our pressure of our water was 18.8 torr. And our temperature was 21.2 degrees Celsius. So there's all of our data. And we need to do some unit conversions really quick because, or we could even just extend out our calculation and see how to do this. Pressure needed to be in atmospheres. And the pressure of our gas was equal to the pressure of the atmosphere minus the pressure of the water. This is going to equal 752.56 millimeters of mercury minus 18.8 torr. But remember that a millimeter of mercury and a torr are exactly the same unit. They have the same intrinsic value. So I can just subtract these two and they'll be in units of millimeters of mercury or torr. I could call them either one, 752.56 subtract 18.8. This is 733.76 millimeters of mercury. But I still need to have this unit. This is the pressure of my gas now. I still need to have this unit in terms of atmospheres. So to put it in terms of atmospheres, the pressure of the gas in ATMs is going to equal 733.76 millimeters of mercury divided by, or we'll use it as conversion factor, for every 760 millimeters of mercury, it's one atmosphere. So this is going to be less than an atmosphere, 0.965, I had what, five sig figs, so I need a couple more. 4.7 atmospheres. So that's the pressure of my gas. The pressure of my, or the volume needs to be in liters. So we'll convert that one into liters. So for every 1,000 milliliters, it's 1 liter. That's going to be 0.237 liters. And now we'll go through and we'll make sure that we've got all the right units. We've got grams, we've got liters, we've got atmospheres, oh, and temp. We need to add 273.15 in order to get that into Kelvin. So that's going to be 294.35 Kelvin. And now we're in Kelvin. So now I have each one of my values and what they need to be. I'll go back to my original equation. The equation was molar mass was equal to mass times RT over PV. That is going to be 0.60. Actually, I want to save enough room. I don't think it's going to fit there, so I'm going to do it down below. 0.60 grams times the value of R, 0.0821. liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin. times my T, which is 294.35 Kelvin, all divided by my pressure, 0.96547 atmospheres, and times my volume of 0.237 liters. So all of that is going in together. I'll punch it in all into the calculator, 0.6 times 0.0821 times 294.35 divided by 0.96547 divided by 0.237. This equaled 63.368 grams per mole. And sig figs wise, when I go through and look at sig figs, this was 2 in my mass. It was 3, 5 for my temperature there. I had 5 in my atmospheres. I had 3 in my liters. 2 is my smallest. So the actual answer that I would report would be 63 grams per mole. That would be my final answer. That was a lot of work and a lot of conversions in going through and doing it. And what we would have done is we would have gone through and done this calculation or done the measurements 3 times. So we would have done the whole experiment 3 times. And we would have waited to do the calculations until the very end, but we would have gone through and reset the experiment, measured the gas tank again, gone through, reset everything, added the gas into the flask and displaced the water, and then done all the measurements again. And after 3 trials, we would have taken all 3 trials and calculated out the molar mass for each of the 3 trials and then averaged them out. On average, what we find is that the molar mass, when you measure this, usually comes between 55 grams per mole and somewhere around 64 grams per mole. That's sort of the range of error that we normally see within this. And the gas that we were actually using was butane. Butane has a molecular formula of C4H6. And so, no, it's not H6, it's H10. And so butane has a molar mass, which is 4 times 12.0114 plus 10 times 1.00794. We're at 58.125 grams per mole was the expected value. And we usually, like I said, see a range between 55 and 64. And anything outside that range means that there was a fairly significant experimental error that could have occurred. But those are the main areas where we, or the main range in which we see the experiment come out, which is a pretty good experiment to be able to measure the molar mass of the gas to 2 sig figs just using a barometer, a thermometer, and a scale. And I guess the last piece is the volumetric flask in order to be able to measure the graduated cylinder or to measure the volumes. And you can get the molar mass of a gas to within 2 sig figs just based on those values. And really what's limiting us to 2 sig figs is that the mass on the balance, the gas is so light that we only get 2 sig figs. If we could find a way to use larger glassware and do it in a larger container and get more sig figs for the mass, we could actually get a better value to more sig figs. But to me, this is one of my favorite experiments because it's so simple in the actual experiment itself, and yet so powerful that we're measuring the molar mass of a gas from first principles and going through and just doing all of these small unit conversions. Okay. I feel like the mathematics part of it and the limitations on how small a screen I have here versus being able to work on a large whiteboard may have gotten a little bit confusing. I don't know how you guys are doing or how you followed that. There was a lot of screen jumping around. So let me ask, how are we doing? How did you guys follow, or do we have any questions in terms of how that experiment worked? Okay, everybody's feeling pretty good. All right. So at the end of this experiment, let me go to my website. That's the chemed.study. Go to the 3L page and the schedule. And on the schedule, we can pull up molar mass of a gas. And at the end of this experiment, and they had a pretty good drawing there too, better than my drawing. There was the table of the water pressures that I pulled out that we used for the table of the water pressures. There are just a couple of questions for you guys to answer on this to complete for this lab. And these are the questions that I would like you to do that are at the end of the lab itself. So the first question says, referring to the experimental determination of the molar mass, explain how and why each of the following factors would affect your calculation of the molar mass. That is, would the calculated value be greater than it should be, or less than it should be, or not changed, noting the relationships and the factors involved? So basically, what they're asking here, they have three different questions, A, B, and C. And then they have, using the molar mass, they give you data, and they want you to go through and use this data. Let's actually copy this page if I can. Let's see how I can do that. I think I can just screenshot this page. We can bring it into our notes. So let's share this and bring it into Notability. And that way we can mark it up. Now we can go back to Notability. And we can zoom in on it. Okay, so what they're asking here, I want this to go away, done. Just done. Delete. Go away. Okay. This is easier because now I have a pointer. So they have A, B, and C. And then down here, what they have is they want you to do a sample calculation where you go through and you use their information in order to be able to calculate the molar mass of a different gas that they're giving you. And this question down here, the last one, B, I don't want you to do. This is using the percent composition to calculate out the actual formula of the gas. It's not something that we generally do in Chem 3. It's not something that the other instructors generally address. So we will drop this piece out and not do 2B, but we will do 1A, B, and C, and we will do 2A, just doing that, redoing that calculation. And that's what I'm going to have you guys do as homework. And excuse me, and in addressing question one, let me give you an example of question one and how this is best addressed. So you have molar mass is equal to grams times RT over pressure times volume. Excuse me. Let's say that what happened during the experiment is that the mass of your sample is actually measured to be too high. For instance, maybe the canister got wet after you delivered the gas, and when you went back and measured the canister the second time, that the canister mass registered too heavy for some reason. And so if the canister got wet and measured too heavy, that would make the difference between the two weighings thrown off, and the mass that you measured would actually be smaller than it was supposed to be. If the mass was measured smaller than it was supposed to be, what happens to the molar mass? So I think about this sort of like an equilibrium, that if the numerator goes down, so we have some value, we have value which is equal to the numerator divided by the denominator. If the numerator goes down, what happens to the value? Does the value go down or does the value go up, assuming that the denominator stays the same? Can you guys throw it into the chat and tells me what happens to the value if the numerator goes down, but the denominator stays the same? It goes down, exactly. They're directly proportional. This goes back to that proportionality example, that things that are in the numerator, the value is directly proportional to the numerator, but the value is inversely proportional to the denominator. So that by using arrows and thinking about this as either being proportional to directly or inversely, you can decide on how the result is affected. You can decide on how the result of the molar mass is affected by each one of these variables, depending upon what they're asking you or telling you here to do. Okay, does that make sense? And the other one is just a straightforward application of just taking all the variables, doing the temperature conversions, and putting them directly into the equation just like we did before. The only thing is that I would say is that for 2A, don't forget that the pressure of the gas is equal to the pressure of the atmosphere minus the pressure of the water. This is the part right here that people forget, that this measurement is being done over water, and you still need to go through and subtract the vapor pressure of the water from the pressure of the atmosphere. So they give you the pressure of the atmosphere, they give you 752 torr, but you need to use the temperature and that pressure table, and they're all in the notes here. So you can go back and I'll post the notes, and that table is directly here in the notes. So you can go back and use the table and you can subtract the pressure of the water from the pressure of the atmosphere to get the true pressure of the gas. So I want you to do those four questions essentially, A, B, C on one and A on two. And that's what I want you to do for next week. Okay? Pretty simple, or at least not a whole lot of work. All right, how about questions? Do you guys have any questions for me? And if not, let's call it good. I'll try to get these posted tonight pretty quickly. I have a meeting at 3 o'clock that is the Faculty Senate meeting that I would like to attend, and it is 3 o'clock now. I will still hang out for a few minutes and answer any questions that you guys have, but that's the lecture for today. And I hope that worked for you. I hope that was useful. I'm seeing in the chat that you guys are saying it was. So thank you. That's awesome. I always appreciate that. I hope that this is working for you, and I hope that it's supporting you in lecture, and I hope that you guys are all healthy and well, and that everything is going well. So enjoy the week. Remember that office hours are always open for you. So anytime you guys have questions, feel free to jump into office hours. I'm still sending out those emails reminding when office hours are happening. And if you have any questions, feel free to email me anytime too, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. All right. Thanks, Crystal. All right, you guys, take care.